November 8, 2006. My name is Sandy Fahler, and I'm an interviewer with the University of Wisconsin-Madison Oral History Project. Today, I am interviewing Michelle Besant, Director of the UW-Madison School of Library and Information Studies Laboratory Library. Dr. Besant received her PhD from the School of Library and Information Studies in 1999 and became director of the Sliss Library in 2003. Good morning.
Good morning.
We're going to start by asking if you would talk about your early life, where and when you were born, describe your childhood, your early schooling, talk about any family members, teachers, or others who encouraged you in your studies.
Well, I was born probably less than a mile and a half from here, Sandy, in what was Madison General Hospital. Uh-huh. My folks were grad students at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, so I feel like I have this long history. In fact, sometimes I feel one foot has been nailed in place. We actually moved a lot when I was a kid, like every year, but it seemed to be in and out of Madison a lot. So I do consider this very much my hometown, not just by accident of birth, but in terms of kind of probably, I don't know, that sense of place you develop, especially in a place like Madison with the lakes and the land. You know, this is definitely my hometown. And I did do early schooling here. We lived in various locations on the Near West Side and out in Middleton. So, and the town was a lot smaller. This is, you know, again, early 60s, and the university was a lot smaller. I think the university as an institution really changed when the population went, because what was it, like, in 68, the population at the university, the student population was still under 30,000. And it wasn't until the 70s that there was this, you know, the huge growth. Mm-hmm. And that changes the institution and a town, it's still a college town while it's the state capital. It changes the feel of the place. I laugh at myself because having ended up back here, I still go to parts of the outlying town and it's like, where did this come from? I literally remember when there was a horse pasture on Bluff Street that's, you know, apartments, you know, so town is, you know, that, again, that sort of geographic attachment to place is very real. But I think while, you know, again, it's this, you know, sort of thing of accident, my mother was a Wisconsinite. My dad had come here for school. He was actually from North Dakota. They met as grad students. But I feel this attachment to the university in that they were literally, you know, in school at the time my older brother and I were born. We used to get handed off on Library Mall for child care duties. First apartment, I don't remember it, was on Langdon Street. The first apartment I do remember was on North Henry Street. So this, again, this sort of sense of place and the air that we breathe as a result of that. Both of my parents did get advanced degrees. My father, a doctorate in actually speech and theater, and my mom was in British history, though she didn't finish that PhD. She instead finished her MLS and became a librarian. But I think we lived in academic towns a lot. We lived in Madison a lot. In high school, I lived in Evanston, where Northwestern is. And we were, you know, so there was that academic kind of milieu, even though we weren't directly involved. So I think that inevitably, and I remember as a kid, you know, where you always had to fill out those things about, you know, what do you, you know, what education level, and as, you know, a kindergartner and first grader, I always said PhD, I thought that's what everybody did, you know, just being around all these academics, it never occurred to me that, no, actually, that was probably a little odd. And at some point, you know, I had thought that I probably wouldn't do that, actually, because I wasn't thinking to become an academic, so... It's you know, I don't know.
Well, what was high school like in Evanston?
High school in Evanston. Evanston was a big, I think of it as the big plant, because we had, my graduating class was 1,100, and that was a fourth of the school. It was modeled on this 4-in-1 school concept, where everybody in Evanston and a share of Skokie went to Evanston. It was very interested. This was in the 70s. I graduated in 76. So... a lot of racial tension because of the demographics of Evanston at that time. We had lived in Evanston a year earlier in 68, the year they had started busing. And that was kind of interesting to live through. I was in a school where they had bused black kids in, and then we were still where kids went home for lunch. And so we, you know, a lot of kids, you know, we'd come home, we'd have kids from out of the neighborhood, you know, come home. And so I got to know kids at that point. When I ended up back there later, you know, it was the point where I would have kids that I'd known as sort of childhood friends, and just they were like, don't talk to me in the hall. Because it wasn't personal that way, but they knew that they would get beat up talking to white kids. And, you know, I have to say, when I look at the level of violence in public schools today, we were really lucky because there weren't guns. A lot of knife fights. But it wasn't necessarily black-white stuff, too. There were interesting dynamics between African-Americans and the Caribbean blacks that were there in places. So there was a lot of that tension, you know, kind of as a backdrop. Big school. Tracking, serious tracking. So there was a relatively small group of kids that I actually traveled with, because if you were on the sort of in the advanced placement classes and stuff,
those were the ones that put PhD down on their,
you know, yeah, that's right.
Survey.
Well, and most of my immediate cohort went off to the Ivy Leagues, you know, out of that, where, as you know, I headed to the State University, which was Champaign-Urbana. I did not come back to Wisconsin.
Oh,
I went down to Champaign-Urbana
okay.
for my undergrad. And, you know, again, a big Midwestern, but smaller than what they were to become, you know, so that sort of in-between place. And actually, having come out of Evanston, which was very academically precocious in many ways, I mean, if you were on the college track stuff, I was miles ahead. I mean, I was shocked because I was really waiting to get to the university and thinking, oh, I'm going to really dig in. This is going to be this intense. And frankly, my classes, my first semester were a lot easier than my high school classes had been because the cohort was different, you know. I was very quickly, because I had taken a lot of advanced placement classes in advanced courses, and so I, you know, very quickly I knew I was at college, but right away it gave me an appreciation for the opportunities I had academically as a high school student. Because, I mean, you know, a lot of kids from places that didn't have decent libraries, for instance, much less the kinds of labs and stuff that we had as a result of being at this big, you know, high school.
Now, why did you choose to go to Illinois? Was that your only choice? Or
it was, I looked at some smaller schools, some of the, actually Vassar, and this is kind of funny, I was really interested in Vassar because they had a seminar in Virginia Woolf, and I was just thought that would be wonderful. But when it came down to it, it was money. It was going to cost four times as much to go to, you know, a small liberal arts school, kind of maybe one of the, you know, the sister schools, or there was a very good university that in those days, I think tuition when I started was like $600 a semester, you know? So it was completely, you know, in comparison, a no-brainer, and it was a good school.
What did your brother do?
Yeah, my older brother had gone to the university, but he dropped out, and then he actually was starting again the year that I went. He's a couple years older. And I did have my family, my parents had gotten divorced when I was in junior high, so I actually had family in Madison. My mom and my two little brothers lived here, and I lived with my dad and my older brother in Evanston. And so I'm not quite sure why I didn't consider Madison. But I was just, you know, whatever you are. I think I was a typical teenager in many ways where, you know, it's just one of the greatest and also most horrendous periods of life. And you're just focused on moving on. And that was the next thing. And that's what I did.
Now, did you have good classes or classes that you remember fondly at Illinois?
Yes. They had, at that time, a honors program in the English department. I went in as an English major. And this is where I guess I was not typical, because I actually went in as an English major and I graduated as an English major, and most kids change their minor many times. But they had this honors program where you were taking seminars with professors that were small classes right away. So amongst my big lecture classes for a lot of my general ed requirements, I had these, you know, small classes. And not that a lot of the teaching assistants weren't very good teachers, they were. And frankly, some of them put more time into it than the faculty, because they had the time and the interest at that point in their careers. But it gave it a very different feel. So I had some wonderful, wonderful people, particularly I remember in the English department because of a lot of involvement there. I did an honors project on the modern poets, which I now think of as the male moderns, because it was Crane and Eliot and Pound and those people, and of course not somebody like H.D. or, you know, Stein, people that I would now put in that. And the professor had me over to her house once a week, and we literally sat in her book-lined study and, you know, discussed. She gave me an hour or two every week, and we would talk about, you know. And I look back at now, and I can't make sense out of some of those people now, so I don't know why I talked about it, you know, 20. But but it was, you know, I felt a lot of, like I got a lot of care and feeding. despite being at, you know, a big state university. And I think I really valued, and I think part of that is having lived in Madison. I think there was this part of going to college was a big university. Again, I think, you know, there's trade-offs. You know, developmentally, where I was, I might have been better off in a smaller school. I was kind of naive and immature in many ways, and, you know, I was strong academically, but I probably, you know, might have been better.
Now, what years were you at Illinois?
I was at Illinois. I went in the fall of 76, went for 2 years, dropped out for a year. You do not want to live in Champaign-Urbana when you're not in school.
Why did you drop out?
I was just sort of not dealing with school. Life had kind of imploded. I was having a rough time, and I realized I could quit for a while, or I could probably flunk myself out. And it's for somebody who was like a really good student generally, and it just seemed to make sense. So I quit, and I went to work for a local discount house. I did somehow have it in my head that I probably had been working in the library on campus. I probably could have gotten much better work, but no, it worked. I could walk there and whatever, and just had this year where I worked 6 days a week, many hours, and was plenty ready to go back, which had always been the plan, but, you know.
Yeah.
And so then I was there for, you know, a couple more years after that. So I think I graduated in 81 instead of 80.
Okay. Yeah. And did you have a goal in mind when you took, when you decided to major in English?
At that point, I really wanted to be a poet. That was that was my direction. And actually, that was the big, it was a big struggle. I mean, my first couple of years, you do a lot of general requirements anyway, though I had proficiency'd out of some stuff and had some credits. I was really nervous about taking a lot of the workshops because I just was not sure how I would get through them. So I made a deal with myself that when I went back to school, I would do that. And so I focused a lot on my writing. And my plan when I left then, I was in a good position to go off to an MFA program because a poet I'd worked with closely there had just won a major award. So the right letters, you know, were in place, and I had won a department award and, you know, stuff. But I knew that what I really needed to do was write. You know, I mean, school gives you some structured, there are craft elements that you can be taught, and it gives you some structured and protected time, which is very valuable. But, you know, at some point, it's all about you do it or you don't. And I knew I needed to be out of just the sort of university workshop atmosphere and just see where I was going to go. So I looked at my English degree as good for anything, which, of course, right away became like waiting tables. You know, but I wasn't really that concerned about it. I was fortunate in, you know, while my mom's family would be solidly middle class teachers, you know, kind of, we had a lot of educators in the family. Both my folks actually were teachers. My dad was a high school teacher for a while and then actually director of ed at what used to be Vokey Tech and it's now MATC.
Oh.
And mom was a, you know, school librarian.
Well, what did he do when you were in Evanston?
He worked for the Chicago Board of Trade. He had been an independent consultant in education. Basically, you would talk to him about what you needed taught, and he would help you design a program. And it could be, he did anything from factory work. I remember he worked on helping people train people on a line for photography development, to he wrote a reading program for Encyclopedia Britannica. And he had done a lot of consulting for the Board of Trade, for their education department, and eventually they offered him a full-time job, and he decided to take it. And so he was head of their education department, education and publications. So it looked like this corporate career, but it was really still about education.
So I interrupted you.
No,
so
that's
you,
okay.
You wanted to write.
Okay, so I wanted to write.
And wait tables.
So when I finished, so I had done the workshops and stuff, and I mean, you know, finished, I had this good experience with that professor. I had another professor who taught a course on American women's poetry. It was actually in domestic imagery and American women's poetry. The semester I dropped out, and she let me continue sitting in on her class, so I did that. And had a, you know, various groups that I worked with. When I left, my mother had offered me her study for the summer. Since I didn't really want employment, and since I hadn't lived with my mother and my little brothers for 10 years, it seemed like a golden opportunity to, like, get to know these people again in a different way. So I thought, sure, I'll come to Madison for the summer, and then I can figure out where I want to go, you know? So I came up to Madison for the summer. Well, by the end of the summer, I was involved with somebody. The next thing you know, we're buying a house, And, you know, I stayed for what became 17 years. and I got here and I did do, you know, some writing, but I did more not writing and had a variety of jobs, including, jobs on campus. I actually had, I think it was called, my title was actually Associate Information Manager over at the Center for Demography. I worked with Ann Cooper in the CDE Data Library.
Mm-hmm.
It started as a student job because I did come back to school. I came back in the English department here. I really wanted to actually go get an MFA, and they didn't have the developed writing program here then that they do now in the sort of late, early 80s. But I knew there were workshops, and I thought, well, I'm here, and I'm not going to move because I'm not. I just, mm-hmm. you know, sort of settle in. So check it out. And it was really clear right away that the English department and I here, while I really enjoyed classes I had here, I got to take the Women Moderns, for instance, from Susan Friedman. and I had some really wonderful classes that I wasn't cut out for the kind of work that they were doing and want and were interested in mm-hmm. terms of their PhDs. But I had really good experiences working with Terry Kelly and Ron Wallace mm-hmm. in workshops and stuff. So after the first semester, and it was a short degree, the master's, I went part-time, and I did do that. But since I was a student, I could also work
sure.
on campus. So when I was finishing that, and it was going to be terminal, they were in need of transitioning a lot of data sets that they had on the big magnetic tapes
mm-hmm.
and needed to reformat stuff, and they needed a body to do it. I was already familiar with stuff, and so they put together essentially a half-time position, and it was advertised as it needed to be, but gee, who was really well, you know.
So was this was an academic staff
so this
position.
Then it was an academic staff position. Okay. But I ended up not doing that for as long as I thought I might, because the Room of One's Own advertised a full-time job, and I'd also been working there part-time, and somebody left. And I decided to go become a bookseller. So that was one of those good financial moves. I was making less working more than full-time with less benefits, just like that. But it was a good decision for me at the time. I really liked the collective atmosphere. I liked what the store was about. I mean, I think that's another sort of, you know, theme of my life. My parents were both strong feminists. I grew up in the height of, you know, sort of second wave feminism. A lot of my high school and undergraduate days were full of, you know, feminist foment in one sort of another. I was thinking before the election here, the last time I'd done a lot of serious door canvassing, I did some for the presidential election, was for the ERA. And I actually found while there were some people who clearly didn't want to talk to me about the ban on marriage amendment that we just had, nobody spit in my face, and that actually happened to me when I was canvassing about the ERA in the 70s. So, you know,
right.
There you go.
Right.
So I took this kind of winding road, as many of us do, and had worked in libraries in undergrad. I had worked actually at the Board of Trade Library one summer, years before that. Had this mother who was a librarian, was a bookseller, had also put in a stint with Grimm's Bookbindery, so I was a bookbinder for a while, and a bookseller for a long time. And so at some point when I did decide, yes, I really am going to leave Madison, I had, you know, relationship had come and gone,
uh-huh.
I had moved, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I wasn't going to take the store with me, even though I really liked that world and being part of sort of the whole women in print movement. It was like, well, what should I do? Because I'll take myself wherever I go, and I may, you know, I haven't really launched this writing career. I was never going to make money at that anyway, but, you
did
know.
You write at all?
I did, but I wasn't disciplined enough about it, and I was discouraged too easily. You know, you have to be willing to send something out several hundred times and have it rejected, and, you know, I would get something rejected several times, and then it would go in the file. So I thought about it, and it was like, and I actually talked to the career counseling people here at the university. They have for folks who, you know, are thinking about coming back to school or something, and then took their battery of tests and talked to somebody, and lo and behold, librarianship seemed like a good idea.
How about that?
And my mom claims that it just was this long path, and that was always my path, and I had just been ignoring it. I blame it on the fact that I spent my prenatal days in the basement of Memorial. But yeah, it seemed to make a lot of sense. And I decided to come back to school. I was like 31, and I really saw it as this kind of this union card degree. You know, I'd been doing all this stuff. I had this work experience and that, but this would open up possibilities. It would give me mobility. Mm-hmm. I thought I was headed to a large urban area. So I came back to school here on the fourth floor instead of
so
the seventh
floor. So you
never
left?
I never left Madison before that.
Was that an easy choice to pick Madison for your library degree, or did you look?
One of the reasons, and I was typical of many people who go to library school at that point. When you look at the economics of it, I mean, this was a good school. It was rated well. The placement, fees were good, and I wasn't going to gain that much by going someplace else. And this was certainly going to be the most affordable. And it felt pretty doable, and I already had, the rest of a life here, so I didn't have to uproot at that point.
Mm-hmm. So did you go full time?
I did. I actually quit my job the summer before I was going. I was going to bike across the country. It was a long planned trip. My dad ended up with a very bad neuropathy that left him temporarily through the summer quadriplegic, and he was living in Mexico at that time, and instead I ended up driving him home after he got out of the hospital here finally and getting him set up. But then I took out student loans. I did my whole master's for the most part, a little scholarship money on student loans and work study. Worked in the conservation lab with Jim Dast. Mm-hmm. Thought I might head in that way, and then found out, one, I was one of the most klutzy people in the lab, and two, it was not people oriented enough for me.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't end up following up on that, but enjoyed it. Yeah. And met a lot of really neat people, all the book artist folks.
Well, talk about your experience then, getting your master's degree. The faculty, the classes, are there some that you really enjoyed?
It's really interesting now, because having ended up in the library education world, I have a very different understanding of it than I did when I started. Mm-hmm. And the whole difference between a professional degree and an academic master's, I wasn't quite prepared, as aren't many people, I think, when they start their master's in library studies, because it's a very different education process. And this school is actually probably more theoretical and intellectually rigorous than a lot of places. But there are these components of a master's in library science or studies that, frankly, doesn't need to be in a graduate school, because there's a kind of hands-on, you need to do it to learn it, mm-hmm. Almost, mm-hmm. Technical school or, whatever. But there's a whole lot of reasons why you wouldn't want to move it. And there's things that make sense. So when I started, and having done it in English and master's here, I was, at first the coursework just seemed, there was a lot of it. There was a lot of ground we had to cover, but it didn't demand the same level of intellectual engagement that mm-hmm. I was used to thinking of being connected to graduate school. And so I was a little, which wasn't to say there weren't courses that you played with big ideas in. From very much in the field, so even the foundations course, which I actually had with Michael Edmonds, that was teaching adjunct then, as he continues to do at times with his many other duties at historical. And we did a lot of stuff around the issues of intellectual freedom and ethics. And Wayne Wiegand was teaching he taught the History of American Libraries class, and he taught the Reading Interests of Adults class. And both of those had a lot of ideas in them connected to, reading and sort of place of the library as an institution in American society, and what does that mean, and of course the sort of history. And I've certainly come to view it as a paradox in many ways, because in some ways it was so much about supporting the status quo, and very much this white middle class institution, and we're going to Americanize the immigrants in terms of the public library movement in that. And then in other ways it really opened an avenue, particularly for women, for employment and this whole other world. And as I've since have, done some of my own research and interviewed people, that both the opportunity and kind of the world that is created Christine Jenkins actually refers to it in her dissertation about young adult librarians as them being quietly subversive. And I think that there's a lot of that in the library world. But you see the paradox about a lot of stuff. One of the issues I always point to is, thinking again, because I think the election's on my brain, but gays in sort of in library land. The American Library Association was the first professional organization to have an officially sanctioned gay subgroup. The Gay Task Force was put into place before homosexuality was removed from the DSM. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that was very radical.
Mm-hmm.
And then as late as 1993, when they put a picture of what had become the Gay and Lesbian Task Force on the cover of the American Library magazine. And I mean, this was like, you know, a bunch of people with a banner. I mean, a bunch of librarians with a banner. This was not the, you know, Mohawks and mostly naked, you know, whatever men on Castro Street. This is a very, you know, not threatening, you know, whatever. And they got unbelievable amounts of really nasty mail.
Really?
About why could you put this on our cover? And I was like embarrassed to have my postman see it. And I mean, really, enough that there was an editorial that, you know. And so you see again this tension between where there's this really, in some ways, progressive profession and this other ways where it's kind of culturally conservative. And I think there's always been those twin tensions in librarianship about a whole lot of issues. That's, you know, just one that stands out.
Mm-hmm.
Women's place, again, that, you know, the opportunity that it offers, as well as the fact that it's a female or dominated or feminized profession, and so in some ways is stereotypical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's all these, you know, around large sort of social issues, kind of paradox. Are we part of the cultural conservators and conservative in that, or, you know, in terms of that we keep this stuff and then both the access to ideas that allows and the history that lets people see, and that we try and collect a diversity of opinions so people can make up their own minds. I mean, you know, that's kind of radical.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's not, you know, it's not a neat one way or the other. And I think that tension is probably, you know, healthy. The little bit of research that's been done, I know, about sort of political leanings, it's dated now and I don't, you know, but it would say that probably as a group we're on the progressive side, but it's not, you know, a clear cut. And it is interesting as sort of the culture wars have loomed up in the last decade, the tensions that are there, and you see it in the editorials and in the professional magazines and stuff in terms of what are we about and what's our, you know, our role and where do larger sort of social issues fit in terms of what we should be doing and should we, you know, that's not directly library focused, is it not, or. So it's probably one of the things that I really, and that drew me to librarianship. It's a service profession. I had a really interesting time working at A Room of One's Own, which is the local feminist bookstore in Madison, and one of the few surviving ones at this point, but one of sort of the big girls in the feminist bookstore world. And that whole network and what that was about, which was literally when these got started as part of the what somebody's called the ecosystem for feminist publishing, because there were the feminist presses, the literal presses, the publishers. There were feminist distributors for a while, though they didn't stick around, but they figured out distribution is always important. And the bookstores, and they all really had to work together for that word to get out. And you had people who had said, well, nobody else is publishing the stuff we want to see. We can't get these ideas out. People can't get the information they need. So they did it themselves. And even as late as I was working in the store, which was the late 80s into the 90s, the power of the written word and the ownership of the written word and what that could mean in people's lives. I mean, even at that point, I would have, you know, witness weekend after weekend people walking into that store and just standing there sort of, you know, someplace between tears and awestruck because they just had never been in a place that they saw themselves in, that had information they were looking for, that they felt safe to ask questions, you know, about things in. And so that power of the word in people's lives and that sharing, and libraries are about that to me. You know, I see a lot of overlap. I see a lot of actually, you know, the Layton librarian was definitely in place in the bookstore. Though we cross paths all the time. I mean, you know, there's a lot of booksellers that have MLSs and vice versa. So I think that kind of the social conscious aspect of librarianship was very appealing to me. In some ways, I mean, there are times when, you know, I've also heard myself refer to it as white glove social work. And, you know, because, you know, you're not really dealing necessarily, you know, with the people and, like, let's get serious here. What do you really need? Better health care, you know. But I firmly believe that in a kind of big sense, you know, libraries are about a lot of the things that I want my community to be about. They're about potential. They're about hope. They're about possibility. They're about exchange of ideas. They're about choosing, making choices, and being conscious in our choices of how we live, and that we can help each other and be a better society. And all of that sounds very idealistic, and kind of, you know, oh, that's nice, you know, and how do you keep the doors open and blah, blah, blah. But I think especially today, when we're in such difficult times, economically, and things have gotten, you know, obviously even more broken around, you know, healthcare, which again, could we figure out how to take care of each other instead of blowing each other up? I mean, and I just feel that, you know, it's if not now, when, that we should choose to be conscious and make choices. And I see libraries and librarianship as part of that, that may be sort of a quiet way of saying we do have choices, you know. And this is an institution that helps support those choices and that gives people access. And, you know, we need to support this stuff. Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm going to jump ahead here, but then I want to come back because
I've gotten way off.
No, but I have to ask you, I know that you're the director of the library, but do you get to teach too?
I mean,
you would be a fantastic teacher.
Well, thank you. So I got my master's. I was going to say, I do a little bit of teaching. I do a little bit of teaching, and one of the reasons I took the job here was I knew there would be an opportunity to do some teaching, and I had been faculty at FSU, and that was a part of leaving there that felt hard because I was starting to, I thought, develop into what I felt was a pretty damn good teacher, and mm-hmm. I enjoyed that. I enjoy working with the students that way, and the reality is life has been really busy, both. Just running the library as staffing changes have happened. I am very careful what I say because I know compared to most small libraries on campus, we have a lot of staffing, but I am the only permanent full-time line. And then Joy, who's an LSA, is three-quarters time, and everybody else is a student. Hmm. And so the turnover, you know, and we're a training library. Right. And so it is about that, but it does mean in terms of moving a lot of things forward or just a lot of daily stuff, which in some senses I shouldn't touch because I have other things I should be doing. I'm the backup for everything because mm-hmm. I'm the one who's there. So the time thing is very real. And to teach well, it takes a lot of time. And, you know, so I do one class, which I do with Abby Loomis. There's the class that's taught in coordination with the campus instruction librarians. And it's a small class because it depends on the placements. There's only 7 to 9 students, and it's a practicum, so they're mostly in the field with the campus instruction librarians, but we have 7 seminars, and I do that. And that's fun because it's really about teaching. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I get to, you know, share and think and talk with people about what's good teaching and, you know, what does that mean and how do you make it happen and, you know, right. It's a quick and dirty on some learning theory. When I was a PhD student, I majored, I majored in LIS. Obviously, I got my PhD in LIS, but I minored in adult ed and literacy. Hmm. So I do have a little more background in teaching than some mm-hmm. PhDs would.
Okay, let's back up a little bit. When you were getting your master's degree, is that when you got involved? When you started the jail project?
Okay, the jail project started. Yes, that's
talk
when
about
I did.
That,
okay,
please.
The jail project, and that's dear to my heart. So mm-hmm. I would be happy to talk about
okay.
that. Frankly, I was bored, and I really didn't know what I wanted to do. In terms of, I thought I was headed to public librarianship because I'd been sort of involved in the social justice, you know, world one way or another. This seemed to make sense. Been working in academic libraries. That was sort of more where my background was. I had this academic background, so in some ways that was a natural path. And I was just restless. And so I dug through what in those days was literally a paper file in the office of possible placements. And lo and behold, in there was this sort of, I'm holding up, looking at this wilty piece of paper that was really old. It was like 4 years old. And it was from Ann Weidlich, who was then the count at the Dane County Law Library, looking for somebody that might get involved with helping get materials in the jail more. And I had no idea if she still wanted some. I thought, that's intriguing. That would be interesting. That would be the public. Why not call Ann and see what's up? So I called Ann. I said, Ann, you know, Weidlich, you know, I said, are you, you know, I'm a library school student, and this looks intriguing, but it's really old. Are you still interested? And she thought, great. So I thought I'd be stepping into this service that they had, and I'd learn a lot, and it would be interesting. And, you know, I talked to her a little bit, and she actually, it was legally mandated in terms of legal materials, so they were getting legal materials in, but in terms of any recreational and other educational materials, nothing had been happening for a while. At various times, there had been projects in there. Dane County Library Services had been in there at one point. The public library had done something at one point, but it had been sitting with nothing happening in terms of library materials for the general population for quite a while. And I kind of didn't know that. Instead, I worked on getting access, which took me like 6 months. And then the day they let me in, they gave me a tour. And then after that, I was just kind of on my own. And the library in the jail at that point consisted of, well, first of all, I want you to picture a cage at Vila Zoo, because I think the jail in the Dane County, in the city-county building, was built about the same time. They share the same kind of bars and that lovely sort of green paint and, the, you know, at least the old zoo till it was redone. And the library was in the back of a room, which was kind of an all-purpose room. It had been the chapel. And you knew that because there was a large picture of Jesus on the back wall that an inmate had put up at one point. It had been the weight room. It had been an interrogation or interview room. And at the time that I got there, it was the locker room for the inmates that were going on work release, the Huber, basically, that would come in. So that was very convenient because the guys really loved it when I was in there trying to process books and they wanted to change. But the library was on the little back area, which is a little raised platform in front of the mural of Jesus. And it was one rickety shelf with all of these paperbacks that were obviously, they were stripped. So they had been, you know, returns, quote unquote. The bookstores had donated illegally, but they were there. And this cart that, you know, was something out of the, I don't know, somebody had handmade this old wooden cart that was like really hard to move. And that was the library. And there had been no, so I thought, well, this will be interesting. But since they'd given me free access, I cleaned up as best I could those books, threw them on the cart, and just started going up and down the hallways in the jail and stopping at the blocks and seeing what people wanted to read. You know, I was blissfully naive. And you know, had a lot of really, you know, interesting interactions. And I did, I mean, but I learned a ton. I learned a ton because I really didn't know what I was doing. I had interacted with people around books a lot, but of course it's a whole different vocabulary with folks who, for the most part, don't think of themselves as readers. And unlike most of Dane County, you know, the population of the jail, 40% of them read below the 8th grade level. So there's a, you know, very different relationship to text. But, you know, getting out there and talking to people was the best thing I could have done in terms of finding out really kind of what was needed. And very fortunately, early on in my experience, so I'd be going in there, because I was going in like 20 hours a week. I was spending a lot of time in that little space and out, you know, trying to find my way around. There was a grad student in adult education, a guy named Mike Exum, who had a lot of interest and background in adult literacy and had done some work in the California corrections before he came back to Wisconsin. He was a native Wisconsinite and was volunteering with Omega School, was the literacy provider in there at the time. And he was, and that was right next door. There was this little classroom right next door to the cell that had the lockers and the library in it. And he was interested in what I was doing, and we got talking, and we really got along, and he had, you know, good suggestions, so we started working together. So as my practicum was winding up, neither one of us wanted to see things just end. Mm-hmm. You know, it was, like, clear from the response we were getting that, you know, people really did value. There's nothing to do at the jail. I mean, unlike the prisons, where there's more programming, not that prisons are where you want to spend a lot of time either, most of us, there's really very little programming, and it's very crowded. It's constantly overcrowded. So you have people, at that point, 90% men. The population has shifted in the 15 years is now 20% women. Mm-hmm. And that thanks to mandatory sentencing around drugs mostly. Mm-hmm. But with nothing to do, they're watching TV a lot and playing cards a lot in very crowded quarters. And so, you know, kind of any sort of escape. And a book can be a great escape or a magazine.
So families can't even bring things in?
Actually, around reading materials, they'd have to have stuff sent in, and some of them could get stuff. But again, you're dealing with a population that doesn't have money.
Right.
And
or
so
time,
it was limited numbers of them that could afford to do that.
Yeah.
So, and it was one of the reasons, I mean, I think, frankly, one of the reasons that the jail administration, at that point, they weren't used to dealing with a lot of volunteers. They didn't have a liaison person and stuff. And so it was a lot of faith on their part, though I think some naivete, too, that they kind of just, I was surprised, because after all the hassle I had to get clearance, and they just, like, there I was. But I think the fact that I showed up regularly, I kept my nose clean, mm-hmm. you know, and was, you know, dependable. But it was sort of a management tool. Program's kind of a management tool for administrative perspective. Better the guys be reading than fighting, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an overstatement, but I think that's one way that programming and that kind of facility is looked at. So we decided we wanted to try and keep it going. So I just continued volunteering there the next semester, as did Mike, and we decided to try and get other students. And we always viewed it from a two-pronged place, because we were also interested in adult education. So beside the direct services to the inmates, we always saw the site as a service learning site for university students and potentially community people who were interested in issues around corrections.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really the goal. And Mike had good connections in the sociology department, and we used to get sociology students and social justice students and pre-law students, as well as a cadre of library school students mm-hmm. who would volunteer with us. And so over time, you know, we'd have a regular group. And when we had that kind of space in there, you know, you could have a number of people go in at once. And so there was one year where Saturday mornings, there'd be half a dozen library school students there regularly. So you'd be talking about the issues that were coming up in terms of the reader's advisory you may be doing and how it related to class. So there was a lot of socializing mm-hmm. and, you know, idea sharing that way. And it was just an interesting environment. I always say for the students here, you know, there's a lot of practical applications that come out of this. I mean, certainly it's a public library audience, except that, you know, again, you probably have a lower reading level than a lot, but you have this huge diversity of people. You have a much higher minority population than you do in a place like Madison, in a public library. So if you think you're headed to an area where you're going to be dealing with more diversity and you come from Wisconsin that's pretty white, it's good to have that. Dealing with bureaucracy and you know, the politics of dealing with institutions and agendas. I always say if you can deal with the jail, you know, city council should be no problem. The care and feeding of volunteers. I mean, you know, so all of those aspects of, you know, that are interesting. And we did have a number of students who took us up on it. There were a number of people that did independent studies, you know, over time and really put in a chunk and developed pieces of it. And so it sort of developed a life of its own. I think the fact that I continued my involvement with the project and Mike did, and then Mike, when he graduated, went to work as a Huber counselor at the jail, and when they opened the PSB, really helped. Plus, I should say, we had really good support from area librarians. Because early on, when I was doing this, it was suggested to me that I contact Francis de Usable, who was the librarian at DPI, that did handled outreach stuff. So I called up Frances, a cold call, but we got to know each other, and she was very interested and sent me a lot of examples of LSTA grants that had been done around related projects and just talked and gave me other contacts, including Viva Kalaman, who is the librarian that's for DOC, was the head of all the libraries in the state for that, and she was a great resource. Though the first time I met her, again, a cold call, she basically gave me a lot of warnings. You know, don't start something that you can't keep going. You know, you got to be really careful what expectations you set up. And, you know, kind of read me the riot act, mm-hmm. in fact, about mm-hmm. sticking my toe in somewhere where it might not belong, which I really actually valued, because it really got into my brain early on that sustainability was a huge factor. You had to make, which meant making a lot of compromises with what we were willing to do over time, mm-hmm. because sustainability was number one. You didn't want to make another set of promises to people who have promises broken to them all the time. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to interact in an environment where you're essentially a security threat or seen that way, and without stability you know, in the project. So to make things work, that sustainability is really important. Mm-hmm. And also Julie Chase at Dane County Library Services. And indeed, by the end of the year, in a management class with some other students here, we drafted what would be a grant for some collection development there and took it to Julie and said, would Dane County Library Services be willing to do something like this and submit it as mm-hmm. That was an LSCA grant in those days. And we had a meeting with Julie Chase and the captain of the jail, and it was really clear they had some history which wasn't altogether good because the jail kind of never followed through on their part of it. And it was clear after this meeting that this was going to not go anywhere. We kept plugging away from our side. And then in time, Dane County Library Services actually wrote two significant grants when they opened the public safety building. Students here actually, again, helped draft something, and then Julie, and she's really good at these grants, polished it up and put in to get a basic collection for the library that was open in the PSB, mm-hmm. so there would be a space there. And then later on, Mike worked with them and got computers in through LSTA money for a job resource center in the PSB. So the bigger librarian, you know, kind of network. And mm-hmm. as word about the project, and I think this, you know, sort of swinging back to the Wisconsin thing, this is very much the Wisconsin idea. There were people and graduates from here who had written about and been involved in the idea of libraries and jails back in the 70s, who I was to meet later, the Hammonds, Anne and Peter Hammond, mm-hmm. had the little pamphlet out back in the 70s. But this whole thing, too, that a sense of, you know, we've been given a lot, and being able to share what we can that might be useful in the wider community is important. And I think that ideal is really lived out in a lot of ways, and this is just a little way. Mm-hmm. But all of the help, and as sort of word got out, area librarians have been good about sending as they're doing weeding or whatever, if they seem relevant, you know, sending them in. And the students here really picked up the ball. And I've had a lot of students at times, I had students win-win. I think it's been a win. There are some basic services. It's not ideal. We use the term library in some ways very loosely because we don't have the space or the ability to staff or would be allowed for people to, you know, come in and use a library, but they do get access to materials. The students, it's very self-selecting in terms of who chooses to get involved, but there's always been a kind of court of spree, and there's been a group of people, and that's ebbed and flowed in terms mm-hmm. of numbers, but that have been very involved. I have had students, as I started to say that one of the reasons they're interested in Madison is because they're interested in this project. And the project, and I think, you know, again, this is partly the care and feeding of volunteers and good fortune, but the project has gained some publicity in time. In 1999, because it was right as I left, I was actually gone from town, but I left, they got a Presidential Points of Light Award. Well, that was huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have pictures of the then, you know, chair of what had become the student group, because they'd registered it, with, you know, Bill Clinton getting this award. The South Central Library Services has recognized the project with their Chester Sneebly, Nifty Idea Award. Right. You know, a matter of fact, there's going to be a little one-page write-up of it in American Libraries this month, because it catches people's imagination. Yeah. And I think a lot of it, too, it is the students. It's the enthusiasm, the interest, the passion that they often show. Yeah. And so many people, I think, do come to library school with some sense, a service orientation, in some sense of social justice ideas, and this is a real outlet, mm-hmm. for a very concrete one. Mm-hmm.
It's spread?
Really valuable that way.
Are there programs that students from here have started?
One graduate, who Amy Gibson, who became Amy Mark, has been involved with things down in Louisiana, I think it is. Mm-hmm. And I know that we have presented at state conference at various times, mm-hmm. in part to encourage that this can be doable. Now, yes, we have a little different situation because we have all these library school students who mm-hmm. are potentially, so it gives you a fairly regular, stable body of volunteers. But, you know, trying to bring across the idea of, you know, the doability of it. And I've had some, you know, people call as follows up to that are interested in suggestions. I don't know how many things have really gotten off the ground. There are other projects. This was certainly not the first, and there are other projects, and there's a growing movement at the prison level. There's a very active group in Illinois that does, what's it called, Books Behind Bars or something, and there's actually a group that spun off from that because the people have moved to Wisconsin, and they're going to be trying to get more materials into the prisons here. Though I think Wisconsin and Maryland, as far as the prison libraries, are probably the two best in the country, because in both instances there's been individuals here, Vibica, who have really struggled and fought and done the year after year legwork and politicking to get something in place. Mm-hmm. But it's always kind of, on this edge, because as in the wider society, so often libraries are looked at as, well, that would be nice, but kind of an extra. Mm-hmm. And so making the case for, the value
right.
can be hard. And, you run straight into the money thing. I think one of the things, too, we're, in fact, coming up in a time where we'll put Louise in her power suit, Louise Robbins, the director of the school, in her power suit, and I'll try and put on some decent clothes and get one of the students dressed up, and we'll go meet with they're not called captain anymore. Because it's really important to maintain the sort of political side of things as well, maintain the ties. The jail system, it's very paramilitary, militaristic, so very much a hierarchy of command and stuff. And we have had the sheriff, very visible support from the sheriff in time, partly because of the 10th year anniversary. He showed up, made a very gracious speech, has been, always political guy that he is. Remember Sue Louise is when she sees him out and says something, oh, I love coming through and seeing all those guys reading, But it's on the radar screen.
Yeah.
And that's important. And we need to making sure we kind of
sheriff now.
Because it does make a difference. Because it's hard. The staff at the jail, the deputies all have to cycle through. It's part of their training. Most of them don't want to be there. Mm-hmm. And so they may or may not want to deal with us, too. And they just don't know a lot of times what, because there's enough turnover. Mm-hmm. So you want to have the pieces in place in terms of that, kind of the higher-ups. You're in agreement with them in terms of your goals and what you're trying to do and basic levels of service that work for everybody. Mm-hmm. And then you can have the support to make that a smoother operation. But it's still hard because stuff happens. I've been in the jail when there's been a lockdown, and then, you're stuck. We had students in there a couple weeks ago, and suddenly a deputy just came in and said, got to toss this place. Basically, they had to leave, and they had to, he was putting on his surgical gloves, and we found out later a dental tool had gone missing. I'm not sure why they thought it was in a book in the library, but they apparently had to flip every book in the library.
Oh, my.
So, we're not always really popular when things like that happen, because even though it turned out, it had nothing to do with us, and they didn't find it, but again, because it existed, they had to go put the time into, and they're really understaffed, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
So the jail library project lives on. It's entering, it will be 15. I always remember how old it is because I consider it starting the day that I first stepped foot in jail, and it was my birthday. So June 2nd, 2007, the jail project will be 15 years old.
That's great.
And I hope... and I hope it continues. My real desire with these kinds of projects is they live as long as they have a good life and that they're useful. Mm-hmm. And as long as it seems like it's serving a good purpose in that both we are able to provide some at least baseline services that seem useful, that it continues to sort of be a way to raise people's awareness around issues and corrections, which are huge in this country, and that... it's working at that end. We have both the services and the service learning end. Then I hope it continues. I do try and take. I've gotten re-involved because I ended up back here, and Louise is way over busy, and she's been the staff advisor. So I became a co-staff advisor and really sort of for the project again. And space has been reduced that they have over there, so we now have all donations sent to the library, and we do the processing and stuff here, and then it'll take it in from here and stuff. But I try and take a backseat role. Part of it is because I went in every week for, a lot of years. And part of it is I really do see it as the student's baby, and it needs to be. And so it does help them to have somebody with some institutional memory and some continuity and to, shore up. And I feel like that's certainly important. And I'll go in. I was just in this last weekend because they needed to do a massive cleaning and they needed more bodies. So,
Is there a collection development policy?
You know, there was one written a couple years ago, actually several years ago now, that I think students did out of the collection development class. That's one thing they've done. There was a website developed for it out of the information architecture class. Students made that their project. There was a collection development policy. I think there's been several pieces of useful things for the project that people have taken on as class projects.
I just have to ask, I'm just curious, how did they do that collection development policy? And did they talk...
We have a really interesting source of data. It's something I actually would like to do something with. We have all the request slips back. When people, we do circulate materials in the CCB, the City County Building, where the jail's on the 6th and 7th floors. It's a lockdown facility. Things actually just go out in milk crates, and they get swapped out. In the Public Safety Building, they take things in book carts, and the volunteers actually go into what are called pods. I hate that terminology, but that's what they're called, which are these inmate living cells. The idea is to have everything there. They get fed there instead of, you know, going out. A deputy lives with them in these, basically, and the volunteers takes a cart in. But besides this rotation of materials, that way we handle special requests. So people can request from the jail library group on this little yellow sheet, that's the same little yellow sheet they use to request to talk to their lawyer or to get a tube of toothpaste or anything, they can request a book. And those, and we have years and years of those.
Well, that would be interesting.
So we know what the kinds of things, you know, are that people want. And they did a sampling of those and tried to make it a little bit more systematic so that we weren't making assumptions that if you looked at it in a systematic way, you'd see we're in error. And they based some of the stuff on that. And then, of course, there are the issues that there are, you know, there are some materials you can't take in. In general, the jail's been pretty good about not, you know, about saying this stuff. But there are things. You can't bring stuff on weapons, martial arts. The pornography thing is difficult. There is, the prisons had to very carefully define what that would be. And it, a lot of it came down to, like, nipple exposure. You know, I mean, that's specific about, you know. And the jail policy is a little more sort of nebulous. A lot of explicits, you know, sex in terms of photographs. The text stuff, they've pretty much not fussed about. But they wouldn't be really happy if we were bringing in, even though it seems tame today, Playboy, much less some more hardcore, you know, kind of. But, you know, there's things that walk a line, and sometimes they're fine with it and sometimes they're not. A magazine that comes to mind right now is Maxim, which has a lot of, you know, half-naked buxom women in it.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And gay stuff seems to not be, can be questioned.
Does somebody actually look through the material, or?
It depends. In theory, it's all gone through before it goes in, and I say in theory because, again, I think how carefully that is, it depends on the deputy on duty that's doing it, and that we have a good track record. We have, and this is something I know sometimes puts me in conflict with some of the students about, you know, my take on things, but I do believe in situational ethics on this, and this is this thing. You know, I really believe in intellectual freedom, but at a level, I'm not willing to have the project die over one magazine or one book. You know, and we've really kept our noses clean. And we're really clear with our volunteers about what's okay and what's not. And that's sort of another whole part of it. I mean, most of the library school students are old enough and mature enough, so, you know, their common sense is a little stronger. We have had some undergrads involved at time who just, like, you know, they would wear really inappropriate clothing. You know, as a woman, you do not go in there in short shorts. Bad idea, you know. And just the stuff in terms of your interactions. Because believe me, you'll get more opportunities for dates, you know. And it's, I mean, it's all about, you know, trying to see what they can get, you know. Sure. And I don't like to really have this us-them thing. But, you know, again, common sense.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of shuck and jive as well, and it's pretty harmless, you know. But, you know, an 18-year-old may have a harder time knowing where the lines are than our typical school student. So we've kept our noses clean.
Let's move on. This was really interesting. I'm glad that we got that on tape. Let's talk more about you, though. We've got you.
So I did my master's
degree.
I thought I was headed to a large urban public library, except by the middle, not even the middle of my second semester,
I was taking on, Deb Johnson was another really important faculty member here for me. Mm-hmm. I had her for several classes. She's one of the, if not the best teacher I've ever had, and I've had a lot of higher ed and a lot of education. And I've seen her handle a small group to a room of, you know, hundreds of people, and she just is a really talented teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And I had my interest in adult literacy, partly JL, and I was also doing tutoring at the Literacy Council in town and stuff. And this Title II B money became available, and there were a lot of scholarships that the department got for the doc program. And again, because of my academic background, I had been given some encouragement by people actually before that money was available, even about thinking about, and I was older, you know, was that some, you know, something that I want to do? And I was kind of feeling like, well, yeah, I've worked in libraries, but I should probably go do that. But, you know, but it was intriguing. And then there was literacy stuff, and Deb was here, and I thought I could work with her. And then the personal side of life, I was re-involved with somebody who had ended up moving here, and it was probably a time frame. I thought, well, why not live with my PhD, you know?
Uh-huh.
Sounds like, makes sense to me. And I had thought when I was 5 years old, that's what
that's
I would
right.
So I decided to go ahead and apply to the program, and they did let me in. I did that, and my path, of course, went like this. Deb ended up not getting tenure, which actually happened, I think, later in that semester, which was just one of those unfortunate things. And I think one of the hard things about an institution like this, because inevitably we are a research institution, so everything is about research, and especially, I think, at that time, maybe a little bit more so than now, though I think social science divisional is still a very difficult. I think they pride themselves on being really hard-ass.
Mm.
And that means that when, you know, you've got professional schools and people doing more applied research and stuff, it doesn't always look right. And, you know, Deb probably did need to do, you know, more publishing. But it's so iffy, you know, because you see some stuff that gets through or some people that come with tenure and you look at their vita versus, you know, what's going on. And here she was, this truly gifted teacher. You know, I mean, just all that stuff. So that was very hard.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Jane Robbins, who was the director of the school, took it very hard. I think partly because I think she felt like, well, what did I do wrong? And I would question, you know, it comes down to a sense, you know, a director has to get her people through. But also, what were the politics and the climate and the university in
mm-hmm.
terms of, you know, moving people through, and what did it look like, you know? And so I feel like, you know, Deb really got caught in the crossfire of a lot of stuff, only some of which was really about her work, mm-hmm. that there were the bigger politics playing out in ways, and it was most unfortunate, to say the least, because I think the school and the university lost a very, you know, valuable mm-hmm. contributor. But anyway, she, yeah, was moving on, but I did stay, and I ended up being a PA as well on the evaluation project. Doug Zwizek and Jane Robbins had a big grant, an IMLS grant, to do a demonstration project around evaluation. There was a lot, this was the beginning of libraries getting on board with what was coming down from the feds in terms of the accountability and some of their models. So we'd been working on our own kinds of evaluation and the output measures. You saw the, you know, the history. It's really all stayed sort of the same, but the language changed every
mm-hmm.
couple of years. Yeah. Well, this was one iteration of that. And it was bringing in state librarians and state library staff to really talk and learn and think more about how to do the evaluation piece well with programming, because that was seen as the weak link by the feds in terms of when they were dispensing money. So that was a great opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And I got launched into a doctoral program, which I was kind of cocky about. And which I remember Doug Zwizek, and we were a big class for the school because there were 11 of us, and typically there's like 3 to 6.
Mm-hmm.
So we were a really big class, and he kind of looked around. We had him for our first in-house seminar, you know, the research methods class, and he sort of looked around, though, and said, you know, and half of you won't, I mean, did the classic sort of, and half of you won't finish, you know,
oh,
kind
dear.
Of thing. None of us, of course, believed
no.
that would be us, no. And what did he think? And he also talked about how it would change our thinking more than we realized, and... Yeah, we all kind of went like, yeah, right, Doug. But, you know, I think he was right. Though I think more than half of us did finish. But It was an interesting process in terms of sort of becoming a social scientist. And I undertook it with the thinking that I really valued that training, particularly qualitative stuff. I'd spent my time, you know, with the demographers and the sociologists when I was working in that environment. And I saw, in terms of how things work in the world, understanding how to see the world through those numbers and large picture sets and stuff was very valuable. And helpful, just pragmatically, because when it came to writing grants, as most nonprofits that I figured I would be headed towards, it would be very useful to have those initials behind my name. So that's really kind of where I started. And then life takes its twists. And I was taking classes, and it was a very different, I think I was fortunate. Having done other graduate work, I wasn't as shocked when I started what was then an academic degree again. Because the PhD is very different from the master's in the school in terms of one's very much a professional degree and one is very much an academic degree. And I know it was a real struggle for many of my classmates in that cohort, many of whom were even older than me at that point and had, you know, well-established careers at fairly high levels, and suddenly they were peons in the, you know, hierarchy around here. Not that they were, you know, treated badly, but it was a shock to their system. And if they hadn't done other graduate work, you know, they were still thinking of their life, and it was just like, oh my God. And I think it is an issue in the field that makes it hard, because there hasn't been the research requirements at the master's level in library education for quite a while. When people step into the doctorate, we really are behind the start line compared to most fields, you know, because most other people have done a research master's, you know, so it just is a lot. I mean, there's quite a learning curve. But it was a great experience. I really felt challenged, and I, as I said, I do think my thinking was, you know, shifted more than I would have thought. It was an interesting time to be a student because of, again, I feel like, you know, we were behind, maybe behind the, you know, sort of the cutting edge, certainly the bleeding edge, and probably even the cutting edge, but in terms of what's happening in the social sciences, really questioning positivism and looking at qualitative method stuff as well as ways to know, and all the discussions just about the sort of epistemological discussions that were happening in the academy at that time, and certainly the feminist theory that was, you know, influencing all of this. And I had had a lot of that theoretical background because that was happening big in the English department in the 80s. You know, some of that, and then just sort of the street stuff I had, and it was interesting to be in a structure where I had to try and think through it in, you know, different ways. So I felt really lucky.
Who did you work with most?
I started out working heavily with Jane Robbins, actually, who was to leave shortly thereafter, and she actually has had a heavy hand on what I ended up doing. I took, actually, as a master's student, Jane Robbins taught a seminar on feminist methodologies. And I learned much later that the reason that that course came to be was because she was at a conference someplace, and as Jane was wont to do, was spouting off about something, and somebody called her on it. And she realized that she needed to know more.
Huh.
And being Jane, and this is where I give her a lot of credit, rather than kind of, you know, turning tail and, you know, whimpering off, she's like, yes, I need to learn more. And so she decided to do the seminar so she would learn more. And she knew my background from the store and stuff, and so it actually hired me as an hourly up front to help her pull some stuff together. So I did a lot of legwork in the library back then. So I had this feminist methodology class with her. And then I did some other independent study work with her around adult literacy. And I worked with Louise Robbins quite a bit, and I worked with Wayne Wiegand quite a bit. And I took the switch. I had come in planning to do stuff around adult literacy, a reading. I thought I might do something with the jail, actually, in terms of that population as readers. And but I had this need to somehow have it have a pragmatic side, so I was wondering, how would you look at, you know, reception of this kind of text, and what would that mean for the development of high interest, you know, reading at a lower level, you know, sort of for new adult readers and that. But I never really got there. And in the meantime, then, Jane Robbins really encouraged me to pursue a paper that I did for the feminist methodology class, which was actually looking at lesbians in the profession. And And as I think in my non-politic way, I sat in their office one day, and Jane, you know, who the fuck will hire me if I do that, you know? And it was just completely, completely theoretical and out here, and would have been qualitative research, and I was here to get my quantitative training, and this all just, but of course, what happened is, in the meantime, I'm taking classes in sociology, and I took a great feminist ethnography class with Jane Collins, and I took her qual methods class, and I also, at that time, got the opportunity to get into the classroom, first here as a TA, and then in a lecture, actually, 551, but in the meantime, as a TA in Women's Studies, in the Women's Studies 103, and that was a great experience, and I loved being in the classroom, and I was pretty good at it. And it was really challenging, and I just thought, this is really fun. So I thought I was headed off in this other direction, but instead I thought, I may have to throw my hat in the ring to do this academic thing so I can do this. So that's kind of what happened. And I did end up doing a dissertation that looked at overlap of identities of lesbian and librarian, and what did that mean? And interviewed people. And actually what women talked about, I had a cohort that was heavily second wave feminist, and from the height of sort of lesbian feminism in the late 70s, even though the age spread was from somebody in their 20s to somebody who was in their 60s, but it had a lot to do with when they'd come out in life and sort of what that meant. And really the, I think ultimately the thing was about feminism, in terms of how they thought that might impact who they saw themselves as librarians, why they were librarians, how they tried to interact. There were some pieces of it that I didn't follow up on that I think would have been interesting. I really think that the library world is kind of this hybrid. Again, you have a lot of very traditional hierarchies in the library world, but it's also very much a woman's world in some ways, at least listening to my informers, and I think a lot of people are attracted to that in terms of communication styles and communication of, in terms of, ideals of what it's about, in terms of the service profession side, in terms of there being a lot of women who really enjoy working with other women. It doesn't matter what their orientation, not, moot point, but a lot of people talked about from the service side that they felt really clear they knew what it was to be an outsider. And so what they appealed to them in library work was, one, it had been a home for them, but that also seeing that in their users, whatever user groups, be it at a university, in a school, and certainly in a public library, that it was really clear that people who were outsiders in our culture, the library really offered a door to learning about themselves, to a wider world, to making connections in ways that may be difficult in other ways. So, so that was what I ended up doing. And it, when I started, one of the ways I was cocky is I was really planning to do the degree very quickly. 3 or 4 years and I'm out of here. And in theory, I could have done that, but of course I didn't. And, I was here longer than I saw, because I started that in 93 and I didn't actually get my degree till 99. I filed my dissertation on April 1st, 1999. I always loved that. More important to me than my diploma is my little yellow stub, which is what they used to give you when you deposited your dissertation at Memorial. It looks sort of like a Greyhound or a Badger bus, locker stub, and it's that you've actually filed, and it's April 1st, so it always seemed fitting somehow.
And then you left.
And then I left, yes. I interviewed for faculty jobs because that's what I wanted to do. I had a couple of job offers, and I decided to follow Jane, because one of the job offers was from FSU, and she was the dean at that point, and it was a growing school. They had a lot of money. It was in a very different part of the world. One of the reasons they were interested in me was because of outreach stuff, and I knew that I would get the opportunity to do some community-based stuff. In fact, they were looking at me because the school wanted to get more involved that way. And there were some good mentors there. Elfrida Chapman in particular was somebody whose work I followed for a long time, and she was there, and I knew I'd have the opportunity to work with her. We had talked during the interview process about that. So off I went to FSU in Tallahassee. I had left town a year before and gone to Denver, where I was had been dating somebody long distance for 18 months, and we thought, well, maybe we should see if we really want to live together before we both move across the country someplace. So I had lived in Denver for 9 months or whatever it was, and then she followed me to Tallahassee. And I did the junior faculty thing for a few years. It was really clear to me in about a year and a half that I wasn't driven enough or focused enough to deal with it. I think I made some mistakes that could have made that different in terms of my research agenda and some opportunities I had that I foolishly turned down that probably would have helped me crank out publications. I was very lucky in the teaching experience I had because I'd done both smaller classes here and been involved with a really large class, and one of the things I was handed was a 100-person undergraduate class that was a lecture, you know, a discussion section format, and thank God I TA'd in one, so I had some idea, but I made some mistakes with that, and I just drowned in work from it. And I did nothing but work, absolutely nothing but work, which is kind of what junior faculty do. And there were parts of that I really liked, you know, because the teaching was great, the challenges of that, but I was perpetually behind on getting my publication stuff out. I did get a chance to work with Elfrida. We got one article out and had a series of three, had a couple things started before she died. But I wasn't getting enough research done. And it was a research one, granted, not anywhere close, you know, on a scale of things to a place like this. But that was part of it. They were very much buying people that came out of serious research ones because they were trying to establish themselves. And so, too, they were really looking to junior faculty to be very productive in the research arena. The administration was very good. Jane and her associate dean, Kathy Burnett, were very supportive. And when I started making noises about, you know, this really isn't working, they were like, don't leave yet, stay, give it another, everybody has a rough first year, it's just the world, blah, blah, blah. But I felt really lucky that I had the opportunity, and I felt lucky that I was able to walk away. Now, it was easier than it might have been in some fields, because I knew there was a real shortage of PhDs in our field. And the reality is, and I think it's true today, and frankly, somebody would be getting a good deal today because of the background I have at this point and more experience, I could get another faculty job, not probably in an institution like this, but at a place that would be a good fit and do some interesting stuff from that. But when I did it, it was like, hey, you know, way back when I set out to continue in the library world and I had my MLS, said, why don't I go do that? So that's what I did. And at that point, it opened up the world because there aren't just library schools anywhere. So we were like, where do we want to go? And we literally made lists of what we wanted in a place, and it couldn't be Madison, it couldn't be Denver, because those were the two places where we spent a lot of our adulthood, and we wanted. And we tried out some different places to spend vacations, and we went to Portland. We liked it. It had a lot of the stuff we wanted, so we moved to Portland, Oregon. So I left Tallahassee in, late May, early June, summer of 2002, I guess it was. I came here because I had a teaching gig here for summer school, actually, in outreach services that had been in the works before I decided, you know, I handed in my letter there. Anne drove our yellow Penske truck out to Portland. I stayed here and taught summer school. She came back. We went to the Michigan Women's Music Festival, which she had never done. We got in the car together, drove out to Portland, and was looking, you know, around and figuring out what I was going to do there. And this job appeared on the horizon in Madison. And I was so ambivalent about even thinking about moving back to Madison that I wasn't going to, you know, I had to overnight my application. And then I thought, I realized I was being really silly because I didn't even know if I'd get an interview. Mm-hmm. You know, there would be a lot of reasons for them not to hire their own. I'm sure there were going to be really well qualified people that had more management experience, you know. But I thought, throw your hat in the ring. Well, I'm not sure why, but I feel very lucky that the search committee did give me an interview. And I came out here, and I had questions, a list of questions as long as my leg. And, you know, and I was in a good position to interview because I didn't have any idea if I really wanted this job. I didn't really care. You know, I mean, I did. Right. Obviously, I had very warm feelings towards the school. I felt then, and I still feel, that this school does good work. You know, I think this school does good work. And I think it's an unusual academic environment in terms of the collegiality that exists. But there's, you know, there were a lot of good stuff, and it's a lovely physical plant, and, you know, there were possibilities, but I was like, well, would it feel too weird? One of the things was, you know, nobody was still here. There were only, you know, three faculty members that were here when I was here, one of whom I'd worked with closely, Louise, who was now director of the school, but I had neither worked nor had a class from Ed or Ann, you know, and everybody else was new. So that took care of a lot of that. Well, you know, I knew a lot of the staff, but they were good people. I mean, that was fine. But it was more, and then I wondered, well, are they looking at me because they know I could be a twofer? They're really down, and, you know, am I supposed to run the library and teach a lot? And it's like, not going out of the frying pan into the fire, yeah. you know. But they made it clear that they know they understood with the staffing and that there would be some cleanup because the position had actually sat empty for a couple months, you know, stuff. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, I just talked to people, and they asked me a lot of questions, and I asked them a lot of questions, and it was a fabulous interview experience. I mean, I really, you know, I left here kind of with my head spinning, feeling like, oh, God, you know, if they offer me this job, I'm really, you know, mm-hmm. going to want to look at it, you know. So, and then I didn't hear from him for a while, so that, well, okay, that's decided, I guess, you know. But it was a great trip, you know. Yeah. But then I did get a job offer and, you know, and talked to Louise and, you know, we negotiated and then boom. So within 6 months, I moved across the country twice, packed up that yellow Penske truck and drove it back. And I feel really fortunate because I think it's a really good job match. When I got here, they very nicely actually held the job for a couple months because I was cleaning up some health stuff and it didn't make sense to come here and be in and out of day surgeries. mm-hmm. And so I got here in the middle of the year and Louise was actually gone that semester, which was probably a good thing because when she came, she was director of the library, which means she had very strong ideas about how things should be done and very good ideas. Right. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I had to not rely on that she would, you know stuff.
Sure.
So I had to just go talk to people. And I scrambled hard for that first year because I was coming and I had been out of the library world long enough that it was like, you know, there was a lot of detail about stuff. And that was like, I think CTS must have wondered, where did they find this person? Has she ever worked in a library? Because I just had to ask all the stupid questions. But people were extremely generous, you know, with giving, as librarians are wont to be. But no, people were really, really nice with that. And I had a big agenda that I'd given in my job talk, which I look at now, I laugh in terms of what I've been able to do and haven't been able to do, but I think it's a really good job match. The job lets me, and one of the attractions was it was clear that I would still be really involved with curriculum and working with the students, and that's, I mean, a big function of this library is that as much as possible, and in a lot of ways, you know, you don't want to overuse it if it doesn't make sense. There's so many good opportunities on campus for the students, and the library system and the librarians mm-hmm. on campus are very generous with making time for our students. And I think it's been a win-win mostly because I think they also get very good labor
yeah.
out of our students.
Yeah.
But you don't want to, you know, falsely make a little project here when there's a really big one happening someplace that people can get involved. But there is daily stuff that make a lot of sense for people getting their feet wet that they can do class projects out of the library, and that's part of it. We do have the computer lab, you know, under us here, and so we've been trying to do more user education stuff in-house, partly to offer in-house stuff for our students that's convenient, but also partly so that they get the practice of doing instruction, which is really important mm-hmm. in today's environment in libraries. I love working with the students. You know, I think, and library schools are students are interesting in that there's this a big age range. The demographics here have shifted down. I remember when I was TAing the course the first time here, I think my youngest student was 24 and my oldest was 55. So this is huge. And there's more youngins today, you know, mm-hmm. like mid to late 20s. But there's still people, you know, coming back, have been out. But anyway, they put themselves in this transition place. And I feel like when people have come back to school, first of all, as adults, they're, you know, they're focused. They know what they want to do. They have, but there's also, they're open to the world in a way. Because they've chosen to put themselves in a transition, which I think forces a kind of thinking things through.
Mm-hmm.
And so the consciousness that they bring to their lives and to what they're doing, it's just really enjoyable to interact with.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there are times I really like teaching the undergrads at FSU, and it was very different because the undergraduate program there, people, it's not librarianship, but it was the information skills and the technology skills. And most of those students were going to be web developers or network administrators. And we had a lot, and it was an open enrollment program, so we had a lot of people who came to us that weren't going to be able to do the whole computer science thing but still wanted the technology, whatever. And we had a lot of African-American males. So I went from teaching, you know, largely, you know, middle-class, middle-aged white women
yeah.
to a lot of, you know, black guys in their late teens, early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really fun. You know, different, whole different set of,
sure.
you know, stuff. So working with the undergrads is really different. They need more structure and stuff, but there is the eagerness and the energy. Oh my God, the energy is tremendous. But, you know, here it's a different population, but again, very enjoyable to work with. And I feel like, you know, it's an unusual job because I do hands-on library work. It's sort of across the board in terms of where I end up sticking my little fingers. It is about it being a teaching facility. And so the opportunity and even the expectation that a percentage of my time is spent that way is there. I have a lot of autonomy in terms of that. I meet with the faculty. I try and meet with them fairly regularly. What are they doing in their classes? What would it make sense for the library to be doing in cooperation with that? And also, frankly, I can use this PhD in LIS. I mean, how many libraries? I mean, because it's this whole sort of the academic side of the field, and I have all this arcane knowledge. When I came through, we did these comps, and I have, at least cocktail conversation and a little bit beyond in a whole wide range in our field, and there aren't a lot of opportunities to use that. While as in an LIS library, it's amazing what I can pull out of my head that is useful to people, and I wouldn't get to do that a lot of places.
Right, right.
So, and I like to think that I bring to the school an understanding of library education, having sat in a faculty and been done a lot of committee work and stuff, that's useful as well. Mm-hmm. And I think, the school is back on firmer ground in terms of bodies and numbers with the hires last year. But I think with things being thin, it was useful to have me have an understanding. And I also think that's probably, the advantage I had in the job interview that I, got it. I actually laughed because I did later hear from members of the search committee that, I wasn't probably the strongest candidate when they started things, but my job talk really was what did it.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, you got it, just in a way that, and I was like, well, you kind of raised me, I should get it. and anybody reading the mission and that, you should have. But I think that certainly the advantage I had is that I had, besides being trained as a librarian, even an academic mm-hmm. librarian, I had been trained as an academic. And this job kind of requires the hybrid.
Mm-hmm.
They really want that kind of viewpoint on stuff as well, because you are going to be involved with the teaching side, and they want somebody that wants to do that, and not every librarian wants to do that, So
that leads to the question of, if you would talk about the culture of the department, and what effect, if any, does it, the fact that you're an academic staff and not a faculty person have?
I'm probably more conscious of being academic staff than the faculty are in terms of how they treat mm-hmm. me. There's long been the culture here, at least long since the early 90s, when the faculty was so small, they really needed the academic staff involved in a different level, and Jim invited everybody to faculty meetings, and were put on committees like faculty.
Mm-hmm.
I just worked with Christine Pauly to redraft, some vision stuff for the school. So, in that way, I'm, very much, but I'm clear I'm academic staff, not faculty. And I do sometimes feel like there's a level of policy stuff, and there's things where it's not that they would say my voice isn't equal. And, I'm not a subtle personality either, so that may impact it, the culture of the school is that, we need everybody,
mm-hmm.
and everybody brings something to the table. This very table, this round table, or now this room, because we don't all fit around the table anymore. And they really value that, and they've worked hard to create that. I think you see it playing out in other ways. The fact that Jane Perlmutter is associate director of the school, and she's not faculty either. Mm-hmm. And yet what Jane has been able to do because of her understandings of the ins and outs of this university mm-hmm. and her background in terms of the doing the stuff with CES and knowing how to make money move in it. It's been crucial, and her grant writing skills that she's been able to, all that stuff. So I think people are really looked at for their skills to some level, but this is a university and this is a Research One university, so when push comes to shove,
mm-hmm.
I'm not faculty. Mm-hmm. And I've actually had, we have a lot of junior faculty, and I had conversations with many of them that, I'm really glad you have your job, and I'm really glad I have mine. Because, the truth is that for me, I wasn't, dealing with it well, while as
sure.
I can do a lot of the things I'm really good at and make a real contribution and not get chewed up
with the pressure of the whole tenure thing.
Yeah.
So, I like to think it's a win-win,
mm-hmm.
And I do think, as I said, that, the school tries to, and in other ways, I'm sometimes going to keep my mouth shut. Not my best thing, as maybe you've noticed, but yeah.
Are you involved in campus activities, campus government?
Right now, I'm not so much, and that's something, I've kind of been here longer, because I'm going on 4 years in mm-hmm. January, and I thought that I would be more involved in some campus committees at this point, and I did almost run for one of the academic staff things. And I was, as a graduate student, I was a student representative on the Faculty Senate GLBTF Advisory Group, and I actually helped work on the last campus climate report that was done. I pretty much did the student chapter, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of that cross campus, and certainly in the library world, there's a lot of stuff, and there was just the reference management, and I keep thinking, I really need to be out there from, from the school. And I haven't, and a lot of that's just been time, and
mm-hmm.
I've got to figure out how to do it. One of the things that is difficult about my job, and, part of it is getting better at prioritizing and time management, which is probably everybody's biggest tricks, and part of it's the nature of the beast, which is that I'm spread really thin.
Mm-hmm.
And so I scramble, and I'm more protective of my personal time than I used to be. So I try not to be here every evening and weekend, which, again, the first year I was here, I just worked.
Yeah.
I needed to, that was fine, and there's times when that needs to be true. But I try not to do that all the time. I feel like mm-hmm. that's one of the choices I made. So it is a time. But I think that kind of work is really important and is also partly what makes this place what it is. The whole faculty governance model here, which is unwieldy and sort of the equivalent with what the academic staff have in terms of structures.
Mm-hmm.
And I really appreciate the time that people do give to what comes out of that for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel what you're hearing is, I think I feel a little apologetic that I haven't gotten more involved up to this point. But it's in my horizon, at least if I don't feel like I have to move because of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And I actually do want to put this on the tape. Given that it's November 8th, after this ballot measure has been voted and we have this constitutional amendment, I don't really care about the gay marriage thing. That was already on the books, not my issue. But the language on that amendment in terms of civil unions or anything like marriage, I do think that any kind of domestic partnership arrangements are going to be in the court like tomorrow. I think lots of things are going to happen, and I think it's going to stall out the university progressing in any kind of serious way with benefits. In this case, there are some benefits, but the health insurance in particular. And it's just really hard to swallow. And this is where being a Wisconsinite and being a hometown kid, it feels really personal.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And when I almost didn't take this job because I was so floored that I thought when I left that the university was well on its way to a full domestic partners benefit package. And I thought, people have been working on stuff for a long time. The study that I was involved with was just another piece of it. But things were moving forward. And it hadn't happened. And I thought, it'll happen in the next couple of years. But I really thought about not taking the job because of that. And I did, and I, as I said, I really expected things would be kind of moving along, and I was, I've been delighted with people who have a lot higher profile and stuff that who have left and have publicly said, especially
mm-hmm.
recently, the biotech guy that walked
right.
out with his millions in research grants.
Mm-hmm.
But it just, this state has a lot invested in me at this point.
Mm-hmm.
My doctoral education, thank you very much, state of Wisconsin. I like to think, I give back to the community and the state in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just feels very personally hurtful.
Mm-hmm.
And, I feel a little funny about that because I'm old enough and came out young enough that I think when I was younger, I never would have thought twice about it. Because a lot of things have happened that I didn't necessarily expect. It's changed, and I'm enough of my own person, maybe an adult at this point, that it's kind of like, damn it, I mean, I'm very much a live and let liver, and there's a lot of public good stuff that I believe in. I don't mind paying taxes. I'm a little not liking paying taxes right now because it's going to bombing people. But I mean, especially local stuff. You got to support the schools. You got, But then there's this part of me that, in essence, you know, a whole lot of us essentially subsidize the system in a way when it comes down to, you know, this insurance. And I had a very, my partner doesn't have health insurance, hasn't needed a hysterectomy. We went to Bangkok, Thailand, because it was a whole lot more affordable. You know, and that was fine. It was actually a good experience. But, you know, again, it's because we're highly educated, could figure out how to do it, what to do it, find a good hospital. And, you know, it's like, that's not really true for everybody. Mm-hmm. And I think the healthcare system in this country sucks. It needs to be overhauled. It should be separated from, you know, marriage or any kind of partnership. It should be separated from the workplace. But in the meantime, it's very real in terms of impact in people's lives. Mm-hmm. And as I said, I think there's, you know, it's a combination of just some personal hurt and maybe some hometown pride, and I feel like we've let ourselves down. So now I've editorialized on that. But it's right, and I think then. Because of, you know, a long history, you know, in this town and with this university, and I think a lot of who I am is connected to what this university is about. Now, my folks were grad students here, for God's sakes. I grew up in the ethos, you know, literally in the shadow and in the ethos of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I hearken back again to, you know, sort of the Wisconsin ideal and a service ideal. And I don't think who I am is completely by accident in terms of relationship to this place. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, having that kind of strong sense of tie, I feel a certain, you know, just sense of, you know, who, you know, what's this about, mm-hmm. you know, and also a real sense of obligation in terms of, it is always the question of how do you make change that you want to see in the world, and I think that comes out of here too. I mean, things aren't necessarily going to be quick. It often is looking to the next generation or, you know, several generations, you know, down. But it just feels, you know, it's hard because at one time the ethos of this university has probably in many ways allowed me to be who I am. And at the same time there's this very in your face, it's really not okay who you are. You know. Mm-hmm. So it's a real mixed message. Yeah. On the day to day, this is a tremendous institution to be connected with. And you know, I think it was interesting to me that you said after talking to people, you know, you kind of felt this reinvigorated, you know, sort of sense mm-hmm. of pride and gratitude. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I do. I think I owe a debt of gratitude to this institution. And I hope how I can play that out is, yes, in some ways, you know, the directly maybe giving back and being involved. But, you know, what I take out into the world, that sense of that we all have a debt of gratitude to each other, that's very Wisconsin ideal to me, too. Mm-hmm. That whole sense of we're on this planet together and, you know, kind of how do we get along the best for the most, you know, best ways and how do you make that happen and how do you take the brain power and, you know, the structures that can help that be utilized. That's what a Research One University is about, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know there's, you know, the sort of the whole culture wars thing, and it can be really, you know, there's a lot of struggling. But even the fact that there can be that struggling, you know, how do we make kind of the best out of that? That's what this place is about.
Mm-hmm. Well, the next question has to do with a culture. Talk about the culture for women on the Madison campus. You were here as a student. You were here as a...
Well, I remember reading, I wish I could remember what report it was now, and I think the culture's gotten a lot better. I think that, again, kind of on the day-to-day for a lot of us, there was a period of time, particularly what I think of as the Shalala years, when you could look around and there were a lot of women in power. I think it was very empowering when she was the chancellor. There was this sense of, you know, yes, and you just looked at who was there. I mean, I remember going to a thing at the Field House, and it was Donna Shalala and Nellie McKay and Toni Morrison standing on that stage. And mm-hmm. it was like, wow, you know, and you could just feel, you know, the whole place, mm-hmm. the energy of that. And I think, I mean, Madison does well in general in terms of a lot of women's issues stuff, but, you know, this is a Research One university, and if you look at the retention, I think recruitment is probably pretty good, and the retention isn't all that good, and the reports have shown in terms of promotion and retention we're still not doing that well. And it's hard. I mean, you know, you run right into that thing that for women, again, especially if they choose to have children, they're still going to be doing most of that. And how do we really change the structures so that, you know, it's not an either-or thing? I mean, we've got to get our heads around. I feel like a lot, well, academic jobs, faculty jobs in particular, but a lot of white-collar work in this country is premised on a model of, you know, you essentially have two people doing it. You have the person who's going to the job, often in a suit and tie that's male, and you have, you know, this other person who takes care of all the other stuff so they can spend as many hours as they do. And our society is premised on that kind of, and how can we get away from that being, you know, the premise? I mean, it's still a problem. How can we get away from in this country that, you know, if you're a white-collar professional, the expectation is that you work 65 hours a week at least, if you want, you know, if you want to get ahead, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, I mean, everybody else thinks we're crazy in terms of how many hours we work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it's a bigger, you know, it becomes a much bigger picture question really fast. But, you know, I think it's still hard for women on a serious research one campus, this one included, even if a lot of the daily stuff is good. And I think there's some pretty good networks and it seems like some pretty good mentorship. But the demands on people, and you think about the woman in the sciences, we were talking about this, or I think about Nellie McKay up the hall, a humanities scholar, but an African-American woman, and how many committees was that person on? Right. You know, and how many women, and I've heard this, I was involved with the Women's Studies Department, and, you know, for a lot of them, I mean, that's like all extra, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, a lot of the, maybe they get their teaching, you know, apportioned, but all the service work that comes with it, you know, and that's the thing. I think a lot of women on this campus drown in service work, and they can't really say, you know, they don't want to say no because they feel like they owe it to the next generation or they owe it, or it's really important that they do this, you know, plus their work that they really want to be doing because that's what really turns them on and they're good at, you know, I mean, so it's just kind of overwhelming. I think a lot of women, particularly faculty, but are fairly overwhelmed because of that service role and not feeling like they can say no. Mm-hmm.
Well, we're getting on towards the end of the interview, and we're going to finish by going back to you. If you would talk about professional organizations to which you belong.
Okay.
Are they important?
Oh, professional organizations, having just come from WLA, which is the Wisconsin Library Association, and I wasn't presenting, per se, this conference I was introducing. Again, I've gone back and forth in my involvement. I would like to increase. And I thought, and probably at the state level to an extent, I am a member of all the associations you would expect me to be, WLA, ALA, ALIS, and a lot of the divisions, ARCL and PLA. And see, that's the thing. Because of what I do, I sort of have a foot in both worlds. So I sort of need to keep up on all the academic library stuff, but I also need to know what those public librarians are doing, you know? And so I go, you know, I try and...
And you have to have that state attachment.
And you want to have the state attachment, that's right. So it's, you know, figuring out where to do that. I think professional organizations actually are. I think they're useful. I think they're important for me in terms of modeling that for our students because I think for a lot of working librarians they're essential. Maybe less so in some ways for people who are connected to big institutions, but when you're in the smaller environments, that really is a professional network and collegial group that, in terms of ideas, as well as pragmatic support around, you know, advocacy issues is essential. Mm-hmm. I see conferences, professional associated conferences, as continued education. And it can be kind of hit or miss, and that's where it gets frustrating. And I'm kind of rolling my eyes because I didn't have a very good experience at ALA this last summer, where sometimes people do presentations and you're like, why did you waste all of our time? You know, it's like, if you're going to do a presentation, do the work to make it good. Mm-hmm. You know. As far as my involvement, again, it's been kind of hit or miss. I've done some stuff with the Library Research Roundtable, but not actively for a while. I am involved with the Wisconsin Women Library Workers, which
talk about that.
Is an interesting group, though, you know, always on the edge of should we keep going. There were women library worker groups, I think in almost every state in the country in the 70s, starting in the 70s. Again, they were an outgrowth from second wave feminism and these strong feminists who were in the library world. And it was purposely library workers, so it was across the sort of range of women in library work, officially librarians and other people in library work. And they did a lot of different things in terms of stuff around, you know, wage scale stuff, general advocacy for, you know, climate stuff, programming, book lists. The local chapter, which was has done every year, I don't know for how long, but going back quite some time, always does a program at WLA. And raises money through a very traditional medium. They do a quilt every year, and the money is given to both Madison and Milwaukee Library Schools for scholarship money. It's never huge sums, but and there's a retreat for the last number of years every fall that brings together library women from lots of different places in the state and kinds of libraries. So it's kind of interesting. Now, over time, I think there's been less visible out there work, except there is still programming at conference, which we just did, and that was, and this year it was actually done in cooperation with the readers section, and it was about women environmentalists and sort of a readers advisory about good books. It was about these women, but they all wrote extensively as well as doing their work. So I've tried to do things to bring up gender issues in the profession, in society more generally, and just kind of keep that overt feminist message out there and in conference and do some fun stuff, frankly.
They still make the quilts?
They still make the quilts. As a matter of fact, there's a raffle. This year's theme was troublemakers.
Whoa.
So it's overt activists.
Uh-huh.
I would say a lot of times the themes are connected to people who you may see as an activist, but you know.
Well, I'll ask you that later. But talk about any honors and awards that you've received.
I don't think I have a list of those. I'm not a big honoree.
You mentioned something when you talked about the jail.
That was really an award for the project.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I take pride in having been involved in it, but it's not, you know, that wasn't, you know, I gave to it as
had
many other people.
If you hadn't found that little piece of paper in the file and decided to do something with it.
But, you know, there's a lot of things in life where, you know, maybe right person, but it's just right time when the things come together. And I think, you know, I am proud of the jail project. I'm proud of the students for keeping it going, and not just keeping it going, but have grown it in ways that I may or may not have envisioned. You know, I mean, I think, you know, you start something and it goes out into the world and it continues or it doesn't, and for a whole lot of reasons. I like to think there was a spark of what that was about that captured other people's imagination besides my own. And so it went out and it's had this life in the world. And it's been recognized, you know, out there. And that's great. And it's great in the very practical sense, too, that, of course, anytime something gets attention, it sparks interest. So it becomes this nice circle. So I'm very grateful, in a sense, too, that it's gotten the attention it has, because I think it's helped, you know, it continues to bring students to it. I think, and that's been true. When I was at FSU, I did get involved with some community project. I actually worked with a local elementary school in a poor neighborhood that had gotten a lot of technology dropped on their heads with absolutely no planning. It's like this corporation had given them all this stuff, but they had no, and they didn't have the time or the money to do the training for, you know, their teachers to really use this stuff well with the kids. And I had all these, you know, students who had all these good skills, so I put together a service learning class, and, you know, we were out there regularly. We did help set up some planning and evaluation for integrating technology into the curriculum, as well as just the students worked with various people to get, you know, websites up for classes and that. But it was the bigger picture stuff. And they, when I left there, the principal did the, you know, threw me a little surprise sort of going away party, invited my dean and, you know, various deans and other faculty from the department, and had all the, you know, the kids came through. And that was really meaningful to me, because, again, it was very touching. I mean, I'd been showing up, and, you know, it was interesting for me, and I was having fun with it, frankly. But, you know, again, I think it's the things where you feel like, you know, I'm doing what I want to be doing, and I did a pretty good job at it, and somebody else thinks I did a good job at it, too. Mm. You know?
Yep.
And that's very nice, mm-hmm. you know. So I guess I hope I'm at that point in my career where maybe, you know, things take off and I can figure out things that really are useful out there in the world that people will feel like they want to give me more honors as I go forward.
I think that'll happen. The last two questions have to do with your life after work. If you would talk about your family, how do you balance your work and your family, and what do you do for fun and relaxation when you're not working?
Oh, my. Well, yesterday I worked 16 hours at the polls.
Fun and relaxation, right? Yeah.
I think, not surprisingly, given that I'm a librarian, I like to read. Mm-hmm. And that always seems like such a dull answer. But, you know, I can't imagine life without the printed word. It's just, you know, again, of course, it was the air that I breathed. And so, you know, it's just, but... so many books have been, you know, you ask about faculty that were important to me, and I think about authors that were important to me, and I
like,
just, you know, have a host of, oh, Audre Lorde, phenomenally important. Adrienne Rich is my, you know, favorite poet, has been since I was 19 or 18. I met her, she used to be in the back of the Norton Anthology of Poetry. And they did things by theme in those days, but they had two authors that they had a substantive collection of things by. One was John Keats, and one was Adrienne Rich. And she was the poet I'd been looking for, you know, since I was 13, all through high school. I'd been given lots of people. I'd been given Sylvia Plath, I'd been given Anne Sexton, you know, I mean, all these people who had these horrible ends. And then here was this truly magnificent poet that I don't know, couldn't believe nobody had, you know, or I hadn't found. And her evolution, both in her craft as a poet and her politics and her essay writing, a lot of, you know, I think of the essay Charlotte Bunch. You know, again, I'm harking back to a lot of, you know, what would have been groundbreaking and really important 70s, 80s feminist theorists, though the more sort of probably less high theory, more street, a lot of theory there, but written in more accessible language, important. And I do, I'm a very eclectic reader, you know. I mm-hmm. read a lot of nonfiction as well as fiction. I read my share of, I'm a typical librarian this way too. I read a lot of mysteries as just, you know, popcorn reading, I think of it as. But, you know, at any given time, besides my bed, there can be a book on, you know, on essays, there could be maybe a book on epistemology. There could be something about, I like the guy who wrote the thing on the bookshelf and practical, how things work, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm a Buddhist of the SGI stripe, and so there may be readings by, you know, from our mentor, Desaku Ikeda. I'm really interested in Thich Nhat Hanh's work, so, you know, there may be stuff there. I also am a physical person. So I like being by these lakes because I like the opportunity to get out on them. I haven't actually been a Hoofers member for a while, but I have done some sailing and mm-hmm. windsurfing and a bicyclist, so I like to get out and do that. I also enjoy being back in Wisconsin and Madison for how quickly you can be in really beautiful countryside.
Mm-hmm.
I like to travel. I've always had the travel bug. Again, I think, you know, living with sort of itinerant parents, we trooped around a lot. And
are your parents still living?
Stay with me. They are. And my mom actually lives in town. She retired a number of years ago. She's 75 in a few months. And my dad lives down in Tucson.
And what about your brothers?
I have three brothers. I have an older brother, Jacques. We all had French names. Jacques, Michel, Christophe, and Blaise, who gets called Blaise. And my older brother lives in town and teaches at Monona Middle School. He eventually did graduate from this institution.
Mm-hmm.
And I have, my youngest brother is now in town. He's actually been quite ill for the last couple of years and has pulled up stakes in Fort Lauderdale where he was and is here till he can finish dealing with his cancer. And I have a brother in between us, Chris, who lives up in Minneapolis and has two little kids. And So I have a lot of family in the area. Mm-hmm. And so that I have a partner of going on 10 years, and we've moved back and forth across the country now numerous times. We have a cat.
Do you still write poetry?
You know, right now, I did last year set myself out to do some exercises, and I have a notebook of just rough draft stuff, and I've been trying to work on some personal essays. I actually have a deadline with a friend who's retired and living elsewhere now, but we have a deadline for mid-December, and I am working on an essay called Hometown Dyke.
Oh.
So we'll see where that goes.
And are you a quilter?
I am a very poor quilter. Yes, I'm the one where when we have the retreat and everybody's quilting away, everybody's got to put their stitches in. So I always put my stitches in, but mine are some of those that I think some of the good quilters would really like to take out. But it's part of the, actually, I shouldn't say that, because it's part of the quilting process. And we really, in the group, we talked a lot about whether we wanted to continue this, but everybody really liked doing it for what they learned, because we always have a theme and we have some speaker about it to get us going and ideas, and then the process and the time shared and the discussions that happen around that. But very much the doing this kind of community quilt is that sort of everybody participates. And yeah, some stitches are really crooked and some people are really good at it, and that's just all part of it. That's what makes it a quilt, right?
Right.
That
right.
coming together. So.
Well, we're at the end of the interview, but I don't want to turn off the tape until you have an opportunity. If there's anything else that you want to get on tape, say it now.
Oh, well, I feel like I'm trying to think of the things that I thought I was going to talk about. Now we've gone all over the place. One question that we didn't get to, which is about where do I think librarian, you know, the profession,
yes.
where my profession is going. And I just would like to comment on that, because it's a fascinating time. As maybe every generation feels this, but certainly in librarianship, it's such an incredibly interesting time with the mass digitization in one form and another going on, so that everything we're doing with that, and you know, kind of what does that mean for what we are and what we do, especially as somebody who is so print and book-centered as I am, and yet I think it's terribly exciting, the access that's being created. And I really hope that institutions larger than the libraries, but the institutions that we're connected to as libraries, learn how to play together as well as libraries have, because I think that's going to be key. Can our universities figure out how to share this stuff? Because we can't all build our own separate repositories. We really need to be sharing it at a different level. And at the same time, and this is what I find interesting too, and you see this more at the public library world, though there's a lot of discussion in the academic library world in terms of libraries' place and what does that mean. And you see that resurgent in the public library world in terms of these big urban libraries that have been built in the last years. I think of Seattle's right off the top of my head, which was this, you know, cool house building, this incredible bit of architecture. You know, San Francisco kind of kicked things off with theirs. What was the library that won the architectural award this year? But there's a number of major urban, centers that are using libraries as, public space. So on one time you hear from people, oh, everything's going to be, online, and, we're really not going to have libraries at all as we know them, because everything is digital and librarians are going to spend all this time, at their keyboards, or maybe they won't be keyboards, we'll be talking at them probably very soon. At the same time, we have this resurgence of library space and public space, and that's incredibly important, and the civic nature of that. So I think it's just, there's so much going on in the library world that's challenging, but exciting and full of possibility, and maybe represents a lot of what's going on in our wider culture in terms of basic human needs to make connection and a very real facing people, and so that thing is placed, and the bigger that what can happen in terms of what our technologies allow today, and what does that mean? And I do feel a real generational divide in that at my age, I'm kind of at the cusp of where things really turned. I will always be a technology immigrant. I will never view the world as the people entering school, college today do, because really you think about it, the net was public starting in what, 95? So that's 11 years. So mostly in these kids' conscious life, that's been part of their landscape. you know, tremendously different world. I never will know what it feels like for that to have always been there. I always will have this gee whiz factor about it,
right.
You know. But, you know, so how do we use it well? And we're facing this, you know, just all over because our technologies are letting us do so much stuff. And I guess a lot of it we're not seeing, all the medical stuff, stuff that's going on in the medical
sure.
world. You know, but obviously that, you know, access to information, access to the masses of information out there, the fact that we really can do that today in ways we didn't think were imaginable, and that it's going so fast, makes librarianship just incredibly exciting. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I don't know, people maybe are starting to get it in a different way. The stereotype of the bun and glasses will probably never go away. I'm really kind of okay with it. But because it's very clear to such a wider world that information and access to information, and increasingly also the importance of even the recreational stuff in the life of the mind that's not just always focused on the bottom line or productivity, they get that how you put this stuff, how you organize it so people can get at it, you know, is really kind of important.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen things, have you had changes in the SLIS library? I know you've been here 4 years. In those 4 years, have you seen changes? Have the students, I know you said students are coming in younger. Have they changed too?
Yeah, they're more tech savvy overall. We do still face the issue in library education that you get enough, you know, second or third career people who maybe haven't been in the environments where they've had the same access to technologies that we mm-hmm. have, and so there can be a little bit of gap. But overall, the bottom level of competencies with what the skills are have gone way up. Mm-hmm. And it's being, you know, there's more stuff being used. In terms of stuff that we're able to do in the library here, I haven't started an in-house digitalization project. There is one at the school through Sonny Kim's digital libraries class. And I have thought there are some stuff, and I've actually been talking to Sue Searing kind of loosely, who's the LIS librarian at the University of Illinois,
mm-hmm.
And she's interested. They have a very good and unusual collection of annual reports, as do we, though ours are kind of scattershot, and that may be of real interest. It may be a good thing to digitalize because they're not widely available, but
sure.
there's great historic stuff. We have stuff back the turn of the century from some big public libraries. Yeah, our annual reports and newsletters is kind of an untapped collection.
Oh, that would be very good.
And so that's, and just in terms of what we're trying to do and with the students, I'm grateful to have some people on staff that have really dug in and also some people that have brought some very good skills so that we're in the process of redoing our website and hopefully making it more interactive.
Mm-hmm.
As well. We did, we use a wiki now instead of a print notebook for, you know, everybody to communicate to each other. We have set up instant messaging, though we haven't announced it yet because we have to figure out with our staffing how to really staff it, because the whole point of instant messaging is that they're being fast, and if you're only checking it every 15 minutes, what does that do? You know,
right.
So we have some things to work out. But, you know, I'm trying to do things that just kind of make the technology the everyday.
Well, I think you were right when you said this was just a great job.
Yeah. Oh, it's a wonderful job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anything else?
I think I'm kind of talked out. I'll probably
okay.
think of things, but I appreciate
Well, I can always come back.
I'm such a rambler, Sandy. That's a dangerous offer.
Yeah. Well, if you think of anything.
Now that I say that, library education, I didn't really get to do my little, you know, 2 minutes on that. And I do, because I do feel, again, this is where the job is unusual, too, that I get to be part of that process. And I feel very lucky. I sometimes characterize my job, and though I realize people in the wider world probably didn't mean anything to them, but to librarians it does, which in a lot of ways, my job is being a school librarian for big kids. Because I really, you know, my job is to work with the faculty and the curriculum and, you know, what makes sense that way, as well as, you know, the sort of typical academic library things. We have this collection and we have these services we offer, but, you know, there's, and I do just, you know, I see them. I see them through the course of their program. Granted, it's a smaller amount of time than if you have a student in elementary school.
Mm-hmm.
But I do get to interact with the students in a different way than faculty do. And quite literally, because I don't grade them except for this one class, you know. But I mean, it's so we have a different relationship, and I do get to bounce, you know, ideas, you know, back and forth, and listen to their struggles with what this is about and everything too. And I think library education is an odd duck in the university in a lot of ways. I think it always has been. It's on my mind because, in part, because of Gorman, Michael Gorman, the outgoing ALA president, whose big push was on, you know, the practitioner input into library education. And there often is this tension, which I think is somewhat of a false tension, but it's put out there in our press, between practitioners and academics and what needs to be happening. We've been having the same conversation forever. But I'm not surprised, because it is really hard to meet both what's needed for the profession and what the students need that way, and what's needed for faculty to survive in a research institution, and for, you know, to bring together that theory and practice in a balance that makes sense. And I think it's always going to be a struggle. And then you put on top of it that we're in a field that changes so fast, you know, you just get that semester's lectures done. And there isn't a course, I think, that people teach here that they can pull out old lecture notes. Well, they may be pull out old lecture notes, but you've got, I mean, the continual. And I know that this is true, and, you know, certainly in the science, I mean, this is people all the time that changes. But it's just, I'm just really aware in a different way since I've been on, you know, this side of the table from the student side of a lot of the things that students have, you know, kind of bump their head up against here that have to do with the bigger relationships of how do you do this kind of program well in this kind of environment, and how do you make it work for, you know, all sides. And it's not an easy question. And so I'll just come back and finish with, once again, I think this school does good work, and I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm very glad that you agreed to be interviewed. Thank you so much. That was so interesting and so important.